26-year-old Paula Sladewski was a beautiful young woman who turned heads everywhere she went. A model whose photos had drawn a great deal of attention with her waist-length blonde hair and piercing blue eyes. She hadn't quite broken through into stardom yet, but she believed she'd make it eventually. And after a vacation to Miami for New Year's Eve 2009, she wanted to give modeling one more shot. Excited by the prospect of celebrating the new year at a Lady Gaga concert, she and boyfriend Kevin Klim flew from Michigan to Miami and began a weekend of partying, eventually ending up at the hot spot of Miami, Club Space. After 2 hours of dancing and drinking at the club, Kevin tried to get Paula to leave, which led to an altercation and Kevin ultimately being ejected from the club. Unsure of where to go or what to do, Kevin took a taxi back to the hotel. Paula walked out just minutes later and disappeared into the misty Miami morning. Kevin awoke to find Paula hadn't returned to their hotel room and began a frantic search for her. Meanwhile, across town, police responded to the scene of a body having been set on fire in a dumpster. The individual had been burned so severely, only the medical examiner could even determine whether it was a man or a woman. 2 days later, Kevin and the North Miami police would confirm that the body was Paula's. This is Trace Evidence, Episode 71, The Horrifying Murder of Paula Sladewski. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today we examine the unsolved murder of Paula Sladewski, a case suggested by listener Paula Noel. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances, examining a different case each Monday. If you have questions, comments, or case suggestions, email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter at traceevpod, on Instagram at traceevidencepod, or join the Facebook discussion group simply by searching for Trace Evidence. You can visit the website at trace-evidence.com for full episodes, social media links, merchandise, and much more. Trace Evidence is also on Patreon, so if you would like to support the show, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence, where you can get rewards such as stickers, pins, and commercial-free episodes. There's also a PayPal donation link on the website for those of you who don't wish to go through Patreon. This show is a complete one-man operation, and your support is greatly appreciated. As a final note, stick around at the end of the show, where I'm going to address the more recent case of a missing person with ties to one of the most disturbing cases I've ever covered. This week we examine the case of Paula Sladewski, a beautiful, bright, and caring young woman whose dreams of being a model were cut short in a vicious act of violence. This is Episode 71, The Horrifying Murder of Paula Sladewski. Paula Angela Sladewski was born on November 15, 1983 in Detroit, Michigan, to her mother, Patsy. Detroit is the largest and most populous city in the state of Michigan, boasting a population of just under 700,000 residents. It is the seat of Wayne County and is also the largest U.S. city on the Canadian border. Paula, though, did not grow up in the heart of Detroit, but in Garden City, a suburb which is part of the Metro Detroit region. In a direct contrast with Detroit itself, Garden City's population is just over 27,000. Patsy was, for the most part, a single parent who would raise Paula along with the assistance of her grandparents and her eldest daughter, Kelly, who was 14 at the time Paula was born. Paula also has an older brother named Thomas. While details about the exact situation are scarce, Paula had no connection to her biological father. Eventually, Patsy would marry Kevin Watkins, who would become Paula's stepfather. But according to Kelly, there was a pivotal period of time in Paula's youth during which she had no paternal relationships, and the absence of that connection may have played a role in her later life choices. While Paula's life may have began with a certain set of challenges, there was one area in which she was always ahead. Even from a young age, friends, family, and even strangers were constantly commenting on and being drawn in by Paula's physical beauty. Patsy would later describe it by saying, quote, "When Paula walked into a room, heads turned," end quote. Paula, though, did not fit into the mold many people tried to cast her in. Oftentimes, her beauty was treated as all that mattered, and her intelligence and passion were often overlooked. While many viewed the growing young woman as something to be admired physically, few were truly aware of the brilliant mind that existed behind those piercing blue eyes. Throughout her time in school, Paula excelled, achieving straight A's. It was clear to her family, as well as her teachers, that Paula was an extremely gifted young woman, and it would be both Paula's intelligence and her caring and compassionate personality that would first place the idea in her mind of pursuing a career in nursing. According to Patsy, Paula was an extremely empathetic young woman and had a strong desire to help others. This manifested itself through an interest in working in the field of healthcare. There, Paula felt, she would be able to utilize both her intelligence and her care to assist those who needed it. As Paula entered her teens and continued developing, she began to first consider the possibility of modeling. According to friends and family, Paula was aware of her looks early on and loved to dress up and play with makeup, even before she knew how to use it. It wasn't uncommon to find a young Paula trying to balance on a pair of heels while making herself up. She also loved to dance and was quite good at it. Her relationship with her mother was good, though when Paula began dating, some would question just how closely her mother was paying attention to her teenage daughter. At only 14 years old, Paula found herself being pursued by a 29-year-old man named David Coleman. According to Kelly, Patsy didn't have much of an issue with her daughter dating a man that much older, but being her older sister, Kelly wanted to put a stop to it. At the time, Kelly was just 1 year younger than Coleman, and it's unlikely you're going to find anyone who believes this relationship was appropriate at the time. After several attempts to get her mother to intervene, Kelly finally took matters into her own hands and reported the situation to Child Protective Services. CPS got involved, Coleman was arrested, and ultimately would serve 2 years in prison and, upon his release, would be added to the sex offender registry. It would seem, however, that Coleman had already made his mark on the younger Paula, and when he was released from prison, Paula was there, now of a legal age, waiting to pick up their relationship where they had left it. Paula was a dynamic contradiction in many ways. The older she got, the more her physicality developed, and many people began referring to her as a real-life Barbie and treating her older than she actually was. In fact, Paula had such an affinity for Barbie that she'd been collecting the dolls since she was a child, and after her death, her collection of more than 500 would be at the center of yet another conflict between Kelly and Patsy. Regardless now, out of high school and still dreaming of a career in nursing, Paula wasn't in a financial position to put herself through school. It was around this time that she began applying for jobs at local strip clubs. Stripping would, in a way, combine two of her previous interests, dancing and modeling. Paula had gotten enough attention from men to know that she could make the conversion of free looks to paid ones, and strip club managers agreed. It was during her time working as a stripper that Paula would dye her hair blonde for the first time, leaving behind her brunette look and adding in extensions that fell nearly to her waist. Indeed, Paula now looked even more so like a living Barbie doll. Kelly would later express her belief that Paula's entry into stripping may have been sparked in part by a vacancy in her life, stating, quote, "I think that's why ultimately she became a dancer. She was seeking male attention, a love that she didn't get growing up," end quote. Suffice it to say, the money rolled in fast. Paula was making a good living at the clubs, working in different venues all around Detroit. It was here that she would sharpen her street smarts and learn that there are men out there who don't always have the greatest intentions. Her relationship with Coleman would eventually break apart, though the two would stay in touch, maintaining a friendship which, for the most part, revolved around exchanging text messages. In 2003, at the age of 20, Paula became aware of a nationwide contest being held by Playboy magazine, where they were seeking out new playmates. By this time, Paula had been doing a lot of modeling. She was being represented by a national agency, had done some catalog work, and was making the rounds of local events such as car shows. Believing that Playboy could truly launch her into stardom, Paula was one of 500 women who made the first cut, and as additional cuts were made, Paula eventually found herself in the top 50. In the end, Paula would be featured on Playboy's 50th anniversary celebration video, though she would not become a playmate, losing out in the final competition. Despite her lack of ever having been a Playboy playmate, this is how the media would later refer to her. It was during her time working at the strip clubs that Paula would meet and begin a relationship with Kevin Klim. According to Klim, when he and Paula first began dating, things went well, but there was somewhat of a conflict about her career. Kevin wasn't exactly comfortable dating a woman who stripped for a living, but Paula was focused on her goals. She'd been saving a large sum of money to pay her tuition, and she propositioned Kevin with an ultimatum. He could accept her working as a stripper, or he could move on to someone else. Kevin decided that his interest in Paula was strong enough that he wanted to give it a shot, and for a period of time, things went along extremely well. Paula actually made so much money from stripping that she and Kevin were able to move to California, where she left the stage behind and enrolled in school. For whatever reason, Paula never finished her degree program. Whether she had changed her mind, become disenfranchised by the curriculum, or some other cause we don't quite know, but Paula left school early. Perhaps it was all that easy money she'd been making. She soon found herself working at the clubs in California, getting hired on as a dancer, and once again she began pulling in money hand over fist. It seemed, wherever Paula went, there was always clientele that was willing to pay to watch her move. Kevin wasn't exactly pleased with this, but as he'd been trying to open his own mortgage business, the housing bubble burst and his business sunk rapidly. Paula became the primary breadwinner in the relationship. For the next few years, Paula and Kevin would bounce back and forth between Michigan and California. While Paula and Kevin were described as being crazy about one another, their relationship had its good and bad moments. According to Kelly, Kevin was a nice guy. She didn't know a great deal about him, but he seemed to make Paula happy. At the same time, their relationship depended entirely upon their sobriety. Kelly would later explain that when the two were sober, they couldn't have been happier. But once alcohol and drugs made their way into the picture, things were turned volatile. There are, on record, multiple arrests of both Paula and Kevin for assaulting one another, though these charges were almost always dropped. In one violent incident, Paula had been arrested for hitting Kevin with a bottle. In another, Kevin had been arrested for allegedly breaking Paula's nose, though Kelly would later claim that the nose breaking was actually the result of an accident. The relationship between Paula and Kevin was yet another dividing line between Kelly and Patsy. Whereas Kelly saw Kevin as a decent guy who was much like her sister, Patsy would later claim that she'd never liked Kevin and that Paula had, on several occasions, confessed to being frightened of him. Patsy would expand on this, saying, quote, "She was scared. She called her ex-boyfriend, texted him saying, 'I'm hiding from the beast.' Just the threats that echo in the back of my head to destroy her life and that she'd never be able to work again." End quote. While Patsy stands by these claims, they have also been contradicted by friends and Kevin himself, who has acknowledged that their relationship certainly had its rocky moments, but that he ultimately loved Paula and never threatened her. Over the next few years, their relationship would have its peaks and valleys, its violence and its tenderness. From an outside view, everyone had their own opinion on the relationship, and while some viewed it as toxic, others believed it was the influence of substances that caused the major problems. Being around the strip clubs as much as she was, Paula had picked up drinking and wasn't one to shy away from throwing back shots until the early morning hours. At the same time, she was taking so-called diet pills, which were amping up her behavior. Kevin, on the other hand, also enjoyed drinking, and in 2008 was part of a bust which saw him arrested for the possession of cocaine in Warren, Michigan. Over the course of the next 2 years, Kevin and Paula would continue on, and during the holiday season of late 2009, they'd find themselves in Michigan visiting with Paula's family. According to Kelly, she'd had them both over for a holiday party, and they seemed happy. They were getting along well, appeared to appreciate each other's company, and they were making plans. Kelly invited the two to spend New Year's Eve with her, as she'd be throwing a small get-together, but they noted that they had other ideas in mind. Initially, the couple planned to fly out to Las Vegas and to celebrate the new year bouncing from party to party and casino to casino all up and down the strip. However, Paula learned something which would change her mind. Always a massive fan of Lady Gaga, Paula discovered that Gaga was hosting a concert on New Year's Eve at the Fontainebleau in Miami, Florida. Desperate to attend the show and to ring in the new year at the concert of one of her favorite singers, Paula quickly grabbed up plane tickets for she and Kevin to head down to South Beach. They planned to ring in New Year's, hit some clubs, and have a little escape from the grind. Paula had been talking about giving modeling another shot when she got back. According to Patsy, the last time she saw her daughter was right before she left when, quote, she said, "Don't worry, I'll be home in time for your birthday. I have something special planned," end quote. The couple arrived on the hot streets of Miami in late December and were able to score some tickets to Gaga's show from a scalper. Everything seemed to be going according to plan. Paula and Kevin attended the show, celebrating New Year's Eve during the concert and having a good time. A man seated behind the couple shot video of the concert on his iPhone. Paula and Kevin can be seen throughout the video and appear to be having a lot of fun, though the man holding the phone, John Williams, will later describe Kevin as aggressive and obnoxious, saying that while others made their way through the crowd, Kevin was pushing people to clear the way. Of course, for Kevin, he had developed a habit of clearing people away, as Paula would frequently draw attention from men who would try to get her attention. After the concert, the couple went out onto the streets of Miami to enjoy the city and the warmth, although the warmth wasn't really there, with temperatures in the low 60s. While out at a local club, Paula and Kevin engaged a bartender in conversation, asking where the best places were to find a good time. It was at this time that they were told about Club Space. Located at 34 Northeast 11th Street, Space had a huge reputation amongst locals and tourists. For the most part, this was the place to be, and Paula and Kevin decided to attend. The club opened on Saturday nights at 11 p.m. and stayed open until the afternoon on Sunday, so it was essentially a 12-hour-long non-stop party involving DJs, live music, dancing, and of course, alcohol. On Saturday, January 2nd, 2010, Paula and Kevin locked in their plans to check out Space for themselves and see what all the talk was about. The two decided to take a nap to charge their batteries. They woke up in the early morning hours and, according to Kevin, Paula engaged in her one-hour procedure of applying makeup and then slipped into a revealing teal dress she'd purchased during their trip. The couple arrived at Space at approximately 5:30 a.m. on Sunday, January 3rd. The club was all they'd expected and more, packed wall-to-wall with people dancing and having a good time. Paula immediately turned heads upon her entrance, and soon she was being swarmed by men who wanted to dance with the young woman. According to Kevin, the two of them had thrown back a decent amount of alcohol, and the guys, as they approached, were more than willing to buy more shots for the buxom blonde. Bartender Raymond Diaz would later describe Paula saying, quote, "She was so blonde and really tan. She had beautiful blue eyes. Her dress was like a neon blue or green. She stood out," end quote. 2 hours passed, and by 7 a.m., Paula was definitely feeling the alcohol and having a good time. According to several attendees of the club, she began to dance more suggestively and seemed to be enjoying all the attention she was getting. Kevin, though, began to feel her male admirers were getting a little aggressive. One guy in particular seemed a little out of control, with Kevin explaining, quote, "I turn around for a second, and he's on her. He's got his hand around her waist, his crotch right up against her, and he's leaning down, and she's looking over at me," end quote. At this time, Kevin approached and cleared the man away. He was used to this. Whenever they went out, Paula was always the center of attention, and he'd learned how to quietly and calmly steer overzealous admirers out of the way, keeping Paula safe and secure. However, on this occasion, Kevin felt that the couple had spent enough time at the club, and it was time to leave. After several minutes of telling Paula that they'd better head back, he grabbed her by the wrist and began to lead her away. Paula pulled her hand back and told him she didn't want to leave. She was having a good time, and she wanted to keep dancing. According to Kevin, before he could even really respond, club security closed in on him and told him they'd witnessed the altercation between he and Paula and that he needed to leave. Bartender Raymond Diaz later explained, quote, "They were having an argument. They were only 2 or 3 feet in front of me. Then he grabbed her arm. That's when I called security." End quote. Kevin argued with the bouncers, though he was cooperative in walking with them towards the exit. On surveillance camera footage, Kevin can be seen talking to one of the bouncers. According to him, he'd asked them if they could please go and speak with Paula and tell her that he was leaving. Kevin would later claim that one bouncer walked away and returned a few minutes later, saying that Paula said she wanted to stay. According to the timestamp on the surveillance footage, Kevin exits the club at 7:17 a.m. Not knowing what to do or where to go, Kevin reached into his pocket and produced Paula's cell phone, planning to call a cab. He always carried her cell phone since she was usually wearing outfits that didn't have pockets. Before making the call, Kevin saw a cab pull up and he hopped in, being driven back to the hotel. He entered the building, went up to their room, and went to sleep, exhausted. When asked about this later, Kevin explained that this was not the first time Paula had wanted to stay and he'd gone home. It happened a lot, as Paula could dance all night, while Kevin would get worn out after a few hours. Kevin awoke several hours later, around 11:30 a.m., when the phone in his room was ringing. The front desk was calling to ask if they were planning to roll their room over for another day. It was at this time that Kevin became aware that Paula hadn't made it back to their room. It wasn't like her not to return, as in previous times when they'd been separated at a club or bar, she'd always been back before the afternoon was approaching. In a moment of panic, Kevin mentioned to the hotel manager that he didn't know where his girlfriend was, and he hadn't seen her since the night before. It was at this time that the manager tried to calm Kevin down and directed him to the Miami Police Department, urging him to file a missing persons report. When Kevin arrived at the police department, he explained the situation, at which time he was told he'd actually need to go to the North Miami Police Department since Paula had been last seen at Club Space, and that was located within the limits of the city of North Miami. After catching a ride over to the other station, Kevin was once again upset when authorities explained to him that it would be better if he waited until Paula had been missing for at least 24 hours. It was a big city, there were a lot of after-hours parties and places that Paula could have been crashing for the evening. At this point in time, it had been 10 hours since Kevin had last seen Paula. Frustrated and dejected, Kevin walked out of the police department and took a cab to Club Space. By the time Kevin arrived, the club was closed. He saw people hanging around the area and spoke to them, hoping that maybe they had some information. He showed pictures of Paula to them, which he had on his phone, but no one seemed to recognize her. He took cash out of his pocket and offered it to a few homeless people in the area, at which time he was directed to a nearby gas station where they had security cameras. It was possible that if Paula had gone in that direction, the cameras may have seen her. Kevin can be seen on the station surveillance system exiting a cab, walking inside and showing pictures of Paula to the man behind the counter, but unfortunately, he hadn't seen her. Growing more and more worried, Kevin took a cab back to the hotel, and then the idea struck him that if the police wouldn't help, perhaps a private investigator would. He quickly came upon the number of David Wasser, a local PI. Wasser answered and later reported that Kevin sounded panicked and upset. After explaining the situation yet again, Wasser tried to calm him down and asked if he'd filed a missing persons report. When Kevin told him what had happened at the North Miami Police Department, Wasser told him to get down there as quickly as he could, as he had some friends and could pull some strings and get the report filed. After officially filing the report, Wasser sent Kevin back to the hotel while he went down to Club Space to see what information he could gather. Wasser was able to contact the club manager. At the time, he was able to speak to employees, some of whom remembered seeing Paula that night. Mike Samuels, the club's head of security, explained to Wasser that it's club policy to eject all parties involved in an altercation. So shortly after Kevin had been escorted from the club and entered a cab, Paula herself had been walked out. Surveillance footage shows that Paula exited the club at 7:21 a.m., just 4 minutes after Kevin and just seconds after he'd driven off in a cab. In the footage, on which Paula appears for only 7 seconds, she can be seen walking to the exit with Samuels directly behind her. At the moment they turn the corner, exiting the frame, two bouncers then follow quickly behind them. According to Samuels, he led Paula to the door and watched her walk down the stairs, step onto the sidewalk, and turn right, heading east. At this time, he witnessed Paula speaking with an unknown man. Samuels later described this man as being a light-skinned African-American with a closely cropped beard, standing approximately 6 feet tall and appearing muscular. The man was dressed in a t-shirt and shorts. Samuels explained that the man talked to Paula for a few moments and then, quote, "They literally walked off holding hands as if they were a couple. They were last seen by me and my staff walking away from the club towards the parking lot," end quote. Directly across the street from Space was another club, and behind that was a large parking lot. This is the last confirmed sighting of Paula. When Kevin was later told about this, he was confused. He didn't think Paula would just go off with some total stranger, explaining, quote, "She knew how to read guys, and listen, she'd been working in clubs in Detroit for 8 years. Detroit's not a nice area, and she hadn't had any problems. It wasn't some random guy from off the streets who walks up to her and she just walks off with him," end quote. Kevin argued that it must have been a man who was around her in the club, had spoken with her for a while, and made her feel comfortable. Club management, however, disagreed, as they have a strict dress code. The man Samuels described was wearing shorts, and you can't get into Space with shorts on. This will remain a point of contention between Kevin and club management. When Kevin was later shown the surveillance footage, he couldn't help but wonder if one of the two bouncers seen exiting the shot immediately after Paula may have been involved in her disappearance. He argued that he remembers an employee fitting Samuel's description, but the club has repeatedly stated the man they saw did not work for them, nor had he been inside. Wasser kept in touch with Kevin as he conducted his own investigation, but every piece of information he gathered led to a dead end. Despite his efforts, Wasser couldn't find anyone outside of club employees who remembered seeing Paula that night. It's rather surprising since everywhere Paula went, she drew looks. It was hard to miss her. She stood out in a crowd, and yet she had somehow vanished into the streets of Miami in the early morning hours, and there wasn't anything which suggested where she may have gone. The only information that both Wasser and Kevin believed they had was that if Paula were able to get back to the hotel or make a call, she would have by now. Kevin began calling all over town at this time, hospitals, police departments, hotels, but everywhere he called, no one had seen Paula. In desperation for answers, Kevin made a call most people wouldn't think to make. He called the medical examiner's office. While speaking to the medical examiner, Kevin gave a description of Paula, explained the last place he'd seen her, how long she'd been missing, and any other details he could think of. After a few moments, the medical examiner asked Kevin to hold on. After what felt like an eternity, the medical examiner got back on the line and asked if Paula had any body piercings. Kevin's heart sunk into his stomach as he confirmed that she did, and at this point he was told that a detective was going to come to his hotel to speak to him. The detective, Michael Gaudio, had caught a case late Sunday night which had both haunted and disturbed him, and Kevin's call was his first lead. Upon arriving at the hotel, Gaudio had asked Kevin again to explain the circumstances surrounding Paula's disappearance. At that time, he pulled a plastic bag from his pocket. In it were two pieces of metal, scorched black, all that remained of body piercings they had found at the scene of a crime. Due to their damage, Kevin was unable to confirm that these had belonged to Paula. Gaudio then asked to see photos of Paula, and together the two men thumbed through Kevin's phone, going picture by picture. In one particular image, Paula was wearing earrings. Gaudio then produced a photocopy out of his pocket and held it next to the picture. The photocopy displayed what was left of an earring, and it appeared to match the one Paula was wearing. It was at this time that Gaudio told Kevin that he believed they had Paula's body at the medical examiner's office, and they'd need her dental records for identification purposes. When Kevin found out the circumstances under which Paula had been found, it was absolutely gut-wrenching. At 9 p.m. on Sunday night, 14 hours after Paula had last been seen, a man named Christopher Michael placed a call to the fire department. 12 miles north of Club Space, in an industrial area near Biscayne Park, a dumpster was on fire. According to Michael, the flames were reaching several feet into the air above the dumpster, and the building directly next to the fire was a propane dealership. The fire department arrived and were able to put the fire out quickly, but when they saw what was inside the dumpster, they immediately contacted the police. Detective Michael Gaudio arrived to what he would later describe as being the most disturbing crime scene he'd seen at that point in his career. Inside the dumpster was the remnants of a body that had been at the center of the blaze. The body was so severely burned, he couldn't even tell whether he was looking at a man or a woman. Gaudio later explained, quote, "We had nothing else to go by other than it was a human being," end quote. For the past day and a half, Gaudio had been trying to get an identification. He'd checked with local departments to see if they had any missing persons, but found none that seemed to match. For the time being, she was labeled as a Jane Doe. However, after speaking with Kevin, Gaudio was put in touch with Paula's family and her dental records were obtained, finally confirming that it was indeed Paula. Investigation into her death was troubled from the start. The medical examiner was unable to determine a cause of death, considering the condition of her remains. He didn't believe she had been stabbed or shot, as he saw no evidence of this, and so he speculated she may have been strangled. This, however, could not be proven. Any forensic evidence which may have been present had been destroyed by the fire, leaving investigators with little to go on. The one positive thing the medical examiner had to offer was that she had been killed before being set on fire, so at least she hadn't had to suffer the pain and torment of burning alive. This, however, did little to assuage the grief of her family and of Kevin. While Paula's sister Kelly was absolutely shattered when she learned the truth, she was determined to find justice for her sister and quickly flew to Florida. While Kelly was making arrangements to get to Miami, Kevin was being questioned by authorities. As both the significant other of Paula and one of the last people to see her alive, he was obviously someone police thought could fill in some of the blanks. When they looked into his background and saw previous charges for assault against Paula, he moved from a potential witness to a person of interest. The next day, January 6th, Kevin was picked up by detectives and driven to the North Miami Police Department for questioning. He wouldn't return to the hotel until after midnight. Kevin was questioned thoroughly about his relationship with Paula, their past, the night she disappeared. He was played hot and cold. The police would alternate from telling him they knew he'd committed the crime to telling him they knew he wasn't the type of person who would do this. For his part, Kevin was extremely cooperative. He waived his rights to an attorney, offered his fingerprints, DNA, and even offered to take a polygraph test. He was extremely forthcoming with investigators, telling them in great detail everything he knew, including about the violent incidents between he and Paula in the past. The final step for investigators was to ask Kevin to strip down so they could photograph him and check for bruises and scratches. Kevin agreed, but there were no marks on his body. Kelly later explained, quote, "Anyone who did this would be covered in scratches. My sister was a fighter," end quote. While investigators found Kevin cooperative and honest, he remained a person of interest. It was shortly after his conversation with police that people began coming out of the woodwork to depict Kevin as a violent and brutal man who controlled Paula and was consistently threatening her. Paula's former boyfriend, David Coleman, the man who had been 29 when she was 14, told investigators and the media that Paula consistently texted him and that she was afraid of Kevin. He went so far as to claim that he'd received a text from Paula shortly after midnight on New Year's Eve saying, quote, "He's going to kill me." That text, however, was later dismissed as though it was taken out of context and didn't appear to be connected to an actual physical threat. Patsy spoke out against Kevin, explaining that she'd never liked him and that Paula was in a constant state of fear in their relationship. Kelly, on the other hand, disagreed and was the one member of Paula's family who believed Kevin's story and supported him from the get-go. When asked if she ever thought Kevin could have done this, Kelly responded, quote, "I never had a doubt. He shouldn't have left her, and he's got to live with that for the rest of his life, and he's devastated about that. He's taken that really hard. He wants to kill himself." End quote. Upon arriving in Florida, it was Kelly's responsibility to have Paula's remains sent home to Michigan. While there, she had flyers printed, connected with Kevin's private investigator, and wanted to go to all the places between Club Space and the dumpster. She affixed flyers to buildings, power poles, and even the dumpster itself. She hoped to drum up attention for the case and even gathered $15,000 of her own money to offer as a reward. To their credit, the owners of Club Space matched that reward, bringing the total to $30,000. It was around this time that the media came in with their own opinions. Newspapers were splashed with headlines about the Playboy playmate who had been murdered in Miami and the violent and angry boyfriend who had been thrown out of the club. They included interviews with people who tore into Kevin, accusing him of all manner of crimes. In those first few days, there were few, if any, stories covering the case that didn't depict Kevin as the prime suspect and most likely candidate to have committed the murder. For Kevin, it was devastating, but to others, it was justified. Patsy remained steadfast in her belief that Kevin was somehow involved. Over the course of the next few weeks, investigators, Wasser, Kevin, and Kelly would all be trying to find out information and figure out who could have committed this horrendous crime, but everyone was coming up short. When asked about Kelly's efforts, Wasser responded, quote, "She's very hurt. She's struggling. She's trying to keep this case alive." End quote. 2 weeks after Paula's body had been found, North Miami police received a call from Club Space. According to members of their security team, the man they had seen Paula walk off with that night was back, hanging around the club. When investigators arrived, they questioned the man and eventually released him. According to police, the man did bear a resemblance to the description they had, but did not appear to be the same man from that night and was able to provide information to clear himself. 2 weeks after that sighting, 1 month after Paula had been murdered, North Miami police received a call from someone who, to this day, has been kept anonymous. The anonymous tipster explained to police that he or she had been present outside of the club that night, had seen Paula and the man she'd walked off with, and had gotten a good enough look at him that police set her up with a sketch artist. Police released the sketch publicly, and the media once again began spinning the story, this time with less focus on Kevin and more on this yet unidentified suspect. The coverage stirred up a lot of calls and tips, but none which led investigators to any solid evidence or suspects. Eventually, Kevin had to return to Michigan. He couldn't continue staying in Florida. He couldn't afford it. And while investigators have said they cannot officially rule him out as a person of interest, the general belief is that he was not involved. When asked about Kevin, Detective Gaudio explained, quote, "Initially, I thought it was odd that he'd leave her there. We explored several avenues of how he could possibly be involved. Nothing ever panned out. His stories seemed credible. In the investigation, we found out everything he was telling us that we followed up on was accurate." End quote. There are other details which seem to lend themselves to Kevin's innocence. He didn't have a vehicle in Florida, which would make it difficult to transport Paula the 12 miles away from the club. There were cab records showing him being dropped off at the hotel that morning, and employees remembered seeing him. The fire had been set at approximately 9 p.m., during which time Kevin could be accounted for as he was already pushing for a search for Paula. His body had no signs of a struggle, and according to investigators, the location of the dumpster was not one a tourist would just stumble across. Gaudio explained, quote, "It's kind of an out-of-the-way dead-end street, so I believe someone in that area knows something about it or had something to do with it." End quote. Police later revealed they believed the perpetrator was a local who knew the area well and felt comfortable dumping the body in that location. The positioning of the dumpster makes it difficult to get a straight line of sight on anyone using it, and so it's believed that the suspect knew that even if someone were in the area, they wouldn't get a good look at him. As for the fire, well, they have a few different thoughts on that. Firstly, that whoever committed this act had to have been incredibly angry at the time. It's a personal thing to murder someone and then destroy their remains. It suggests a certain level of brutality. Beyond that, it's their belief that the fire was set to destroy forensic evidence, possibly that of a sexual assault. Gaudio explained, quote, "You're doing it for either there's hate involved, anger, or you're trying to cover something up, some type of evidence. We have somebody that's very comfortable in their surroundings who felt like they had a lot to lose if this woman was found." End quote. Unfortunately, little, if anything, has developed in the 9 years since Paula was murdered. There were clashes with the family, arguments about Paula's possessions. According to Kelly, Patsy wanted to auction off many of Paula's belongings. Patsy later claimed that she was doing this to try and gather money for a reward. Kelly was extremely upset by Patsy's actions, though when prompted about it, Patsy responded, quote, "I feel I have a right to Paula's things. I'm her mother." End quote. For Kevin, upon his return to Michigan, he still had charges to face from a previous incident with Paula. One charge was dropped, and he pled guilty to a misdemeanor assault charge. For the most part, Kevin doesn't do interviews or discuss the case much anymore. It's a painful memory that he still struggles with, and whenever he does speak, there's always a backlash about his possible involvement. In the 9 years since Paula's murder, three prime theories have been purported about what may have happened to her that night and who may have been responsible. The first theory argues that the most likely suspect is Kevin. There's a history of violence there, and witnesses who claim that the altercation between he and Paula at Club Space was more than he made it out to be. Several people, including Paula's own mother, claim Paula was frightened of Kevin, and some believe he may have been very angry about being thrown out of the club and Paula's dancing with other men. The second theory, partially brought on by Kevin, takes a closer look at the employees of the club. In the surveillance footage, two bouncers can be seen walking towards the exit immediately after Paula passes by, while Samuels, the security chief, argues that they were merely coming to support him and make sure there were no other incidents, some believe that one or both of these men could have followed Paula. The third and final theory is that Paula's murder came as the result of an interaction with a complete stranger. Whether this man had been in the club or simply met her on the street, several witnesses did see her in the company of an unknown individual. Paula was last seen walking with this man towards the parking lot, making many wonder if he offered her a ride to her hotel, but instead had darker plans in mind. 26-year-old Paula Sladewski was murdered sometime between the hours of 7:30 a.m. and 9 p.m. on Sunday, January 3rd, 2010. 9 years have come and gone, and for a case which garnered so much attention at the outset, little, if anything, has been revealed since. No new information, tips, or witnesses have come forward since the composite drawing was released. What is known, beyond any doubt, is that someone knows exactly what happened to Paula that night, and a monster who could do such a terrible thing to someone is still walking the streets as a free man. Paula's family has been devastated by her loss, with Kelly stating, quote, "If I could have traded places with her, I would have in a minute. She was young. She never got to experience getting married, having a baby." End quote. There's nothing left that can be done to save Paula or to bring her back, but there remains the possibility of justice, of someone paying the price for what they've done. Patsy dreams of being able to find the truth, of being able to look into the eyes of the man who stole her daughter away and to witness him being placed behind bars for the rest of his life. It's bad enough that Paula was murdered, but what was done to her body afterwards is horrifying, and her family was deprived of ever seeing her face again, or even of having an open casket. of being able to live without the image of her badly burned body haunting them for the rest of their lives. Paula was cremated, and Patsy had her ashes placed into a necklace she wears every day. When asked about the case, Patsy replied, quote, "Before I go to be with her one day in heaven, I would just like to know who's responsible for hurting her, for taking my baby away, especially the way she was taken." The murder of Paula Sladewski is a story I hadn't really heard much about. I'd heard mentions of her name, references to Playboy, and I knew that she had been killed, but I didn't know the circumstances. Digging into this case revealed so much disturbing information that I felt compelled to cover it. There's something about the desecration of a body that just always bothers me, whether it's cutting it up, burning, or some other method by which to mutilate someone's remains. Murdering someone is horrifying enough, but to steal the ability of the family to really say goodbye takes an extra level of evil. Paula was a beautiful, bright, and loving young woman. She had plans, dreams, aspirations, and family. She wasn't perfect by any means, but she deserved much better than what she got. Her murder broke a family apart. It shattered a man, and it haunts a detective. This is a truly horrifying case. Before getting into the theories, there is one thing I'd like to address. Whenever I cover a case of someone who had a drug problem, or worked a career some people don't consider acceptable, or anything really that reveals someone may not have been a purely innocent, clean-cut person, I always receive some comments along the lines of, this person should have known better, or this person should have led a cleaner life, or whatever. It's exceedingly frustrating to me that there's this imaginary moral line where if someone crosses it, a certain portion of the population feels like maybe they didn't deserve to die, but their life isn't worth as much as someone else's. For me, all of these lives, every case I've ever covered, are all deserving of justice and attention. I don't draw lines in the sand as to who lived a morally righteous life versus who didn't. It's not my place to judge. Justice is for all, not just those the majority deems acceptable. I say this in hopes of stemming the flow of these emails and comments, but I know they're going to come anyway, so I'll get off my soapbox and move on to the theories. This case, in comparison to some I've done, isn't all that old. While it's cold, it's not yet frozen. 9 years isn't that long of a time, depending on your perspective, but when it comes to solving a murder, it does appear that this case still has a lot of potential. Without evidence, facts, or answers to many of the questions swirling around this story, three theories have been suggested in an attempt to fill in those blanks. The first of these theories points to Paula's then-boyfriend, Kevin Klim. It's been well established that, at best, Paula and Kevin's relationship was rocky, and at worst, it was rather toxic. While there was obviously love there, the combination of alcohol, drugs, jealousy, and financial issues contributed to a great deal of stress and conflict. When the couple met, Kevin was developing a mortgage business. Paula was saving for college. Within a few short years, they were in California. Kevin's business was belly up, and Paula had left school and was back to stripping, which Kevin never really liked to begin with. Certainly, this provided an atmosphere that can lead to the kinds of problems we saw taking place between the two of them, with both of them being arrested for assaulting the other on several occasions. I by no means want to sugarcoat things here. It wasn't good. Many of us have probably experienced something like this before, whether it was friends or family members, a relationship where it just seemed two people are fighting like cats and dogs, or they're calm and happy. There doesn't seem to be much of an in-between, and that certainly fits this situation. Under no circumstances is it ever acceptable to assault your partner, but I wasn't in this relationship. I don't know the details, I don't know what happened, I only know what police reports depict, and in most cases those charges were dropped. The only reason Kevin even pled guilty to a misdemeanor charge in Michigan was because Paula wasn't there anymore to argue for the charges to be dropped. Regardless of where you stand on Paula, Kevin, or their relationship, we have to cast that aside and look at the facts that we know. Surveillance footage shows Kevin leaving the club at 7:17. According to him, as well as surrounding witnesses, he's traveling back to the hotel in a cab when Paula exits 4 minutes later at 7:21. Now, the argument has been made that Kevin should have been there, and while I agree in spirit, because I wouldn't leave my girlfriend behind, we also have to accept that this happened before and things had been all right in the past. This was not the first time. Things, of course, were made worse by Kevin being in possession of Paula's phone at the time, but then again, he tried to get her to leave with him twice, and both times she declined that option. It likely wasn't until she was taken out of the club that she even realized she didn't have her phone. Why club security didn't tell Kevin that Paula was going to be ejected as well, I don't know. Maybe it was an attempt to prevent another altercation from happening outside. Either way, according to the security staff and witnesses present, when Paula exited the club, she turned right, heading east. She was approached by a man who began speaking with her. They clasped hands and walked off together towards a parking lot behind the club across the street. At the same time, Kevin was still being driven back to the hotel. He arrived, went to his room, and went to sleep. When he awoke around 11:30, he spoke to the person at the hotel front desk. He told this person that Paula was missing. He went to the police department to file a report, was sent to another department, and the report still wasn't taken. He asked around town, showed Paula's pictures, and even hired a private investigator. By the time the official missing persons report was filed and Kevin was back at the hotel, it was nearly the time that the fire was started. When you line everything up in this story, the timeline doesn't really provide Kevin with the ability to pull this off. First of all, he'd had to have found Paula after waking up but before the dumpster fire occurred, so sometime between 11:30 and 9. Kevin would have had to have murdered Paula, gotten her body to the dumpster, set the fire, and gotten away without being seen and without a mode of transportation, since he was taking cabs everywhere and had no car in Florida. He would have had to have committed the murder without receiving a single bruise or scratch or tear to his clothing, or splashes of blood or DNA onto his clothing or skin. Not impossible, but really improbable. At no point did Kevin attempt to lie to authorities, bend the story, or tell things any different than they were. In fact, Kevin actually told police about the assault charges before they discovered them. He didn't try to hide anything. He offered fingerprints, DNA, polygraph, whatever they wanted. He allowed them to photograph his body, to examine his clothing, to question him without a lawyer present for more than 12 hours. He was eager to clear things up so authorities could look for Paula's killer. It's rare that someone commits a crime this hideous and then is out pushing so hard for someone to look for the victim. Remember, he tried to get authorities involved and then hired a private investigator when they wouldn't. These don't really read like the actions of a guy who was trying to avoid detection. Of course, some have argued this was all part of some evil plot that Kevin had come up with in order to make himself look more innocent. When you look at the witness accounts, statements from the employees of the club, and the investigator's thoughts on the killer, nothing fits with Kevin. He isn't from the area, nor did he know it well. He was not the last person seen with Paula, and cab records showed he was gone at the time she left the club. He was the main driving force behind the initial investigation, and never failed to cooperate. Regardless of his behavior at the time, a lot of rumors were thrown around. Kevin was depicted as a violent and controlling man who had the capacity to murder Paula. It's hard to disagree with the violent part, considering their history, but almost no one reads him as a killer. That doesn't necessarily mean he isn't. In almost every interview he's given, at some point, he loses control and starts crying. He doesn't come across as smug or like he's trying to dodge a question or hide anything. His story is always consistent. So what is there to suggest that Kevin may have committed this crime? Honestly, it's mostly based on the past assaults and the fact that he was thrown out of the club. That's pretty much it. Even investigators have said they don't think Kevin was involved, but they don't have enough evidence to eliminate him as a person of interest either. Of course, now it's been 9 years and nothing has ever been found to connect Kevin to Paula's murder. While it's possible that Kevin could have done this, the facts and logical thought seem to dictate otherwise. The odds simply are not in favor of Kevin being the man responsible for Paula's murder. In fact, Kevin had his own thoughts on who may have been responsible, and that leads us to the second theory. When Kevin saw the surveillance footage for the first time, his attention was drawn to the two bouncers seen walking out after Paula. His thought was that one or both of these men may have used their positions as employees of the club to disarm Paula, to get her attention, and to lead her elsewhere. Kevin brought this story to investigators, and While for the most part, not much has ever been found to prove it, Detective Gaudio has said they can't rule out any of the employees as being the possible perpetrator. Kevin later returned to the club, in disguise, believing that the composite sketch resembled one of the employees who was there the night Paula disappeared, specifically the man who was checking IDs. However, after this visit, Kevin said it appeared that a lot of the staff was new and the people who had been there that night were now gone. The management team at Club Space disagrees, saying that at the time of the visit, the employees were the same ones who had been there the night of the murder. The club owner called Kevin's accusations ridiculous and said he has the pay stubs to prove it. Mike Samuels, the head of security for the club, has also argued against Kevin's theory. According to Samuels, the two men seen following Paula in the footage are actually following him. It's a policy there for bouncers to support one another when they're leading someone out of the club so that things don't get out of hand. Whether it was a man or a woman, the bouncers saw Samuels leading Paula out and followed as they're supposed to. Beyond that, Samuels has said the man they saw Paula with outside was not an employee, had not been in the club, and they hadn't seen him before. It's impossible, club management suggests, that any of the bouncers could have left without being noticed, as all the employees there are there until the next afternoon and are required to clock out of their shifts with a biometric system that scans their fingerprints. Essentially, if one of the bouncers had pursued Paula, he'd have to have made it back in time to clock out in the afternoon without anyone having noticed that he'd been gone for hours. This is certainly possible, and the club management could be covering their asses, but it seems unlikely. Would you want to continue employing someone on your security team who may have murdered someone? Probably not. Not to mention, a murder at a club is never good for business. There really isn't much to connect any of the club staff to Paula other than that quick surveillance footage. My initial thought upon seeing it was not that they had followed Paula to make sure Samuels was safe, but probably more related to the fact that she was an extremely attractive woman in a revealing dress and they wanted to get a look in daylight. Not all that surprising, really. Now, if all we had to go off of was the club's opinion, this option might seem a little more logical, but we have to bear in mind that there's at least two witnesses outside of the club who corroborated their story of seeing Paula with the unidentified man. In order for it to have been a member of the staff, this individual would have had to have gotten out of the club, changed clothing, avoided being noticed by his coworkers, gotten Paula to go with him, committed the crime, and made it back to clock out. This, much like the Kevin theory, seems unlikely. So that leaves us with the final theory, the one which most people are pretty sure is accurate, but also the one with the least amount of information available. Multiple witnesses saw Paula in the company of a man, walking hand in hand towards a parking lot. We don't know the context of their conversation. We don't know how drunk or sober Paula may have been. We don't know why they were going that way or if they knew each other in any way whatsoever. All we know is that the man was seen closely and long enough to have a very detailed composite drawing created. This guy just happens to be hanging around outside of the club at 7 a.m. on a Sunday. It seems possible he was there just looking for someone to take, and Paula happened to come along at a bad time. But once the man and Paula vanished from sight, the possibilities of what may have happened are almost endless. We know where Paula ended up, but unlike so many murder cases, we don't know a cause of death, or a time of death, or a location of death. Paula was gone for a little less than 14 hours, from 7:21 a.m. to approximately 9 p.m. That is a really large window of opportunity, and remember, this wasn't some middle-of-the-night abduction that took place here. When Paula left with the man, the sun was rising and the day was beginning. So what happened? Investigators and most people who examine this case speculate that the suspect likely took Paula either to his home or a remote location where he knew no one else would be around. How this man convinced Paula to go with him, we don't know. But one theory is that he offered her a ride home. Again, Paula wasn't stupid and certainly had street smarts, so it seems unlikely that some random guy was just like, hey, want a ride? And she thought this was a good idea. It does seem like there's something more involved with that aspect of the case, but we simply don't know what it is. Unfortunately, there's just not a lot to examine with this theory. It does seem most likely that the man last seen in Paula's presence is the one responsible for her murder. Possibly a local, which would fit investigators' profile of someone who knew the area well and was comfortable. While we have no idea as to why Paula was murdered, the most common belief is that the man who took her that morning likely attempted to sexually assault her. Unfortunately, due to the fire, there's just no way to know forensically what happened prior to her death. Again, even the idea that she was strangled is an educated guess. But were that the case, you'd have to wonder how it all went down. Remember, she isn't put into the dumpster and set on fire until sometime shortly before 9 p.m. when the fire department is called. So what was going on for all those hours that she was missing? Some believe that Paula was likely murdered fairly quickly after being taken. Others believe she may have been kept alive and subjected to who knows what. It doesn't seem likely that the man who put her in the dumpster simply stumbled upon it. It's located down a dead end in the middle of an industrial area, and unless you know it's there, you're not going to find it. This seems to suggest that whoever committed the crime was at least familiar with that area, but also comfortable in believing that no one was going to see him at that time in that place. I find it fascinating that he chose to set the fire in a dumpster beside a propane business. It almost seemed like this was done to get attention. Remember, this is Miami. It would have been a lot easier to just go into the ocean and weigh the body down. Authorities believe the fire was set to both conceal Paula's identity and destroy forensic evidence, which does seem like the most likely reason. It becomes exceedingly frustrating. It's hard to speculate. It's hard to theorize because we have so little information. 14 hours is a very long time for a woman to be in the presence of a man, or perhaps a group of people, who will ultimately kill her. It's heartbreaking and terrifying to try and imagine what her last moments may have been like. The composite sketch is quite detailed, more so than you usually see in these cases. The sheer fact that it hasn't matched anyone yet is disturbing, especially if the man is local. But then again, he had a beard, so he could have easily shaved that off and looked completely different. Regardless, the common belief is that whoever committed this crime, whoever the man was who was last seen with Paula, may still be living in the area and walking the streets as a free man. The murder of Paula Sladewski is an incredibly disturbing, heartbreaking, and terrifying case. It's everything you could fear for a young woman out on the town. 26 years old, having a good time, drinking and partying days after New Year's, like thousands of other 20-somethings on the same weekend. One fateful morning, she walks out into the rising light and vanishes along with a man who was never identified. Beyond the shadow of a doubt, there's at least one person who knows the answer. Perhaps that person is listening right now. Until further evidence is discovered, the composite is identified, or someone comes forward with additional information, the horrifying murder of Paula Sladewski remains open, unsolved, and growing cold. If you're looking for more information about the murder of Paula Sladewski, there are a few articles and online discussions available. Dateline did an episode on her case in the past, but honestly, there is not a great deal of information available publicly. If you have any information about the murder of Paula Sladewski, please contact Detective Michael Gaudio at 305-891-8111 or the Miami-Dade Crime Stoppers at 305-471-8477. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, or comment in the Facebook group. Before ending the show, I did want to address a recent missing persons case. Jacob Paddock Weeks, a 26-year-old young man, crashed his white Dodge Ram truck into a guardrail at approximately 8 a.m. on February 2, 2019. The crash occurred on Highway 285 in Indian Hills, Colorado. Jacob has not been seen since. There was no sign or indication at the scene that any serious injuries had taken place, but left behind were Jacob's phone and wallet. Drug paraphernalia was also found in the truck. The crash was determined to have been due to a mechanical problem related to a tire rod. Jacob is actually a relative of Candace Hiltz, the young woman whose brutal murder I covered in episode 16. According to family, Jacob has never really been the same since Candace was murdered and has struggled quite a bit with drugs and the law. They're very concerned about his safety and well-being. A missing persons report has been filed with the Jefferson County Sheriff's Department. Jacob was last seen in person by his uncle in Denver the day before he went missing. A warrant has been issued for Jacob's arrest due to a parole violation, and his family is hoping that he is safe somewhere, but there is nothing to suggest where he may have gone. Let us hope this does not become another story of a young person who disappears from the site of an accident. If you have any information about the location of Jacob Paddock Weeks, please contact the Jefferson County Sheriff's Department at 303-277-0211. I've posted some information about Jacob on social media, so please share that and help bring Jacob home. This year, CrimeCon will be held in New Orleans from June 7th through the 9th. Amidst exciting presentations and inspiring discussions, I'm really looking forward to attending and representing Trace Evidence on Podcast Row. If you're planning to attend but haven't yet purchased your pass, you can save 10% by using the promo code TRACE19. Simply visit CrimeCon.com, select a standard pass, and use the code TRACE19. That's TRACE19 to save 10% today. I look forward to seeing you there. A special thank you goes out to Patreon producers Amanda Lee Ruth Smith, Krista Colvin, D'Earthy, Diane Dyson, Eamon Brady, Kate Alexander, Megan Cotter, Tara Doble, and the Reigns of Yesteryear. If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence. Visit trace-evidence.com for all episodes, social media links, merchandise, and more. I want to thank you all for listening to this episode, and remind you that if you're planning to attend CrimeCon in New Orleans, to use the promo code TRACE19 for 10% off a standard badge. I'll be on Podcast Row, and can't wait to meet all of you. Thank you all for listening, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.